This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
In Somalia, the government has declared total war on al-Shabaab militants, but al-Shabaab continues to strike deadly blows.
Life in Mogadishu is just uncertain. It's beautiful, it's nice, but things can just unfold in the blink of an eye.
And it's her job to monitor North Korean propaganda, so when North Korea started producing TV entertainment...
Honestly, I kind of liked it.
Inside Pyongyang's new television crime drama. Plus, Chef Hawa Hassan was scratching her head.
I've been trying to figure out why hadn't African cuisine crossed over to the mainstream.
So she put together a cookbook of recipes from East African grandmothers. In Bibi's Kitchen has won a James Beard Award. Plus, nearly three decades on the silver screen in Mumbai, now a Bollywood favorite, is coming to a Broadway stage. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. We start the program on this Monday in the Horn of Africa, in Somalia. For many years, the Somali government has been in a vulnerable position under regular siege from the insurgent group known as al-Shabaab. Its militants want to establish an Islamic State there. Recently, Somalia's government launched what it's called a total war on al-Shabaab to try and push it out of cities and towns. The government has had some success. It's taken back territory and pummeled militants with airstrikes carried out with help from the U.S. military. But the insurgents are hitting back. On Sunday, al-Shabaab set off a bomb and then stormed the offices of the mayor of Mogadishu, the Somali capital. In a video that is difficult to watch, government workers are seen jumping out of second-story windows to seek safety. At least five civilians were killed in that attack. Mohamed Gobobe is a reporter in Mogadishu and was about a block away when the bomb was detonated. Mohamed, thank you very much for being here. What did you see and hear on Sunday?
Yeah, it was around noon. I heard two blasts, one after another. Immediately what followed those two blasts was gunfire. And then chaos and panic. And after a while that gunfire was going, armed gunmen from the insurgent group al-Shabaab stormed the compound.
And those people who jumped out of those windows, do you know if they managed to escape?
Video circulating on social media of individuals jumping from windows at the mayor's office are authentic, and yes, it did occur. But at the moment, I cannot name, say yes or no if this individual survived or not.
Understood. Now, the mayor's office is in a well-guarded area of Mogadishu. There are concrete barriers, there are roadblocks, and it's not far from the presidential palace. How did the militants get inside?
That's the question everybody's asking themselves, because adjacent to the municipality headquarters is the Mogadishu Mall, the largest mall in the city. And just to access that place, you have to get off about a block away and walk because of the checkpoints and the screenings. So for members of al-Shabaab to actually penetrate the area and then storm the facility and actually overrun it is just, it's a shock to a lot of people.
So these sorts of attacks, Mohammed, are often carried out by suicide bombers, young men and sometimes women who have heeded the call of al-Shabaab. What motivates these young people?
Some people might join Shabaab for safety reasons, for protection. Others might carry the same ideology. Or some cases, there's a lot of people in Somalia whose family members have been killed in U.S. airstrikes or whose family members have been killed by foreign troops in the country. And naturally, they develop a particular anger. So they take up arms against the foreign forces.
Right. So the U.S. military's Africa Command is training and advising and equipping Somalia's army. Do Somalis generally support the U.S. presence and their actions?
Most people I've encountered know. Most Somalis believe that the U.S. is not a genuine ally, particularly when it comes to the prospects for peace and stability in Somalia. Most Somalis, whether they support Shabaab or not, have a disdain for the fact that there are foreign troops from hostile neighboring states deployed in Somalia, and these troops in Somalia are there as a result of America's global war on terror. So the war on terror is being used as an excuse by neighboring countries to have troops deployed in Somalia with the full blessing of the United States. So yes, a lot of Somalis view the presence of these foreign troops as hostile, which plays into the hands of Shabaab at the end of the day, to be honest.
So just to get a sense of security in the capital, Mohammed, how safe do you feel in Mogadishu these days? Do you go out for coffee or spend time in hotel restaurants or even walk on the beach?
Mogadishu is a city of shifting loyalties, meaning nobody's ever neutral, and therefore not everybody will be fond of what you do. Mogadishu can be a place where you'll be here for several weeks and nothing would happen, and then out of nowhere, the blink of an eye, something can just happen, like what occurred this past Sunday. So it's beautiful, it's nice, but it's uncertain. Things can just unfold in the blink of an eye.
Mohammed Gaboba is a reporter based in Mogadishu. He joined us from the Somali capital. Mohammed, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The Pacific island nation of Vanuatu is reaching out to the UN's highest court for help. Vanuatu wants the UN to spell out exactly what nations are required to do about climate change under international law. The island's hope is the UN's action will get nations to work harder to keep global temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius, a key benchmark to fending off the worst impacts of climate change. As the world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports, Vanuatu's very existence hinges on decisive action.
Vanuatu is far off the eastern coast of Australia, and it's particularly vulnerable to climate change. Prime Minister Alatoi Ismail Kosakau said in a recent speech that it's the nation's biggest threat.
We know that more can be done, and so it is time to bring legal tools and motivations to keep us below 1.5 degrees.
The legal tool he's talking about is an advisory opinion from the United Nations International Court of Justice. And it's prompted by a legal question countries can formally ask the court to answer. In its current draft question, Vanuatu is asking what countries are required to do to protect the climate system and what the consequences are if they don't. Christopher Bartlett manages the country's climate diplomacy.
And we're quite convinced that with the broad range of treaties and conventions that all UN member states have already agreed to, there are very clear obligations that states have to do their utmost to prevent harm from climate change.
The court's advisory opinions are not legally binding, but international lawyer Catherine Amirfar says they're still significant.
They're authoritative statements of the law. They carry great legal weight and moral authority.
They form the building blocks for future legal cases, she says.
The other thing that advisory opinions do is that they frame the terms of the political discussions. So they provide a legal analytical framework for the problem, as well as leverage for further diplomacy or legal actions.
The idea of getting the UN's highest court to weigh in on climate change is not new, and at least one attempt has failed. But that didn't stop a group of University of the South Pacific law students from raising the idea with a minister from Vanuatu back in 2019. Salomon Yeo says he and his classmates were looking at current international climate policy and realized
there's a lot of gaps that are still there.
For example, the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. It gets countries to set targets for cutting planet warming emissions, but those cuts are voluntary.
The only mechanism that's in place to hold them accountable is peer pressure. So what have you done? Or what have I done? So things like that.
Yeo and his law school classmates wondered if a decision from the UN's highest court would bring more accountability.
At minimum, what is governments around the world need to contribute according to international law in terms of the target?
Yeo finished law school and is now fighting for the initiative with other young activists. The formal question that Vanuatu submits to the UN must win a majority of votes in the General Assembly to be forwarded to the court. The country has mounted a PR campaign that includes a song and music video featuring local artists.
We're calling out to you, International Court of Justice, and advisory opinion.
As of last week, Vanuatu's Christopher Bartlett says around 112 countries have expressed their support for the initiative. He's at the beginning of a month-long trip in Europe trying to increase that number.
The biggest challenge that we've faced so far is that the first assumption is that this is somehow climate litigation, that Vanuatu is somehow trying to point a finger or assign blame or seek some sort of damages or compensation from someone who's done something wrong.
Bartlett says that's not the goal. Rather, he says an advisory opinion would help countries when setting their own domestic climate policies. Vanuatu hopes to have the General Assembly debate and eventually vote on the legal question in mid-March. It typically takes about 2 years for the court to produce an answer. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Given inflation and the cost of dining out these days, maybe the idea of cooking at home seems more attractive. There's a cookbook out that's probably got some dishes you have not tried to make. In Bibi's Kitchen has been getting attention and praise, including winning a James Beard Award. What's cool is that the cookbook highlights recipes by East African grandmothers. From Nairobi, The World's Halima Gikandi has more.
Chef Hawa Hassan says food is the glue that holds families together. She was born in Somalia, but had to flee as a child because of the civil war there. Eventually, she settled in Seattle, Washington, but she never forgot the taste of home.
I miss the smell of unts. I miss the smell of halaj and cinnamon, you know, shah being made in the morning.
As an adult, Hassan has had success in the food industry in the U.S. after a brief career in modeling. She's been on the Food Network and eventually created a Somali-inspired condiment company called Bus Bus. But she's been surprised by how little African cuisines are showcased in the U.S.
I've been trying to figure out why hadn't African cuisine crossed over to the mainstream. And I just kept thinking about ways to demystify that our food is hard to come by, that Africa's one country, that our cultures are monolithic.
Hassan tells me that is what inspired her to put together a cookbook to highlight both her own Somali food culture and also that of the wider East African coastline that hugs the Indian Ocean. But that's a big region, so Hassan narrowed her focus even further.
You know, we all have grandmothers. How could I bring the story even closer to home? And so outside of wanting to talk about our cuisine, I also wanted to talk about our elders whose stories we weren't keeping and who were being left out of the narrative.
The result is the cookbook In Bibi's Kitchen. Bibi means grandmother in Swahili, a language used all along the East African coastline. The cookbook features traditional recipes of grandmothers from the region, from Somalia, Kenya, Mozambique, Tanzania, Madagascar, Eritrea, Comoros, and South Africa. Many of the recipes use similar spices that arrived by ancient trade routes across the Indian Ocean, like hawash, a Somali spice blend.
Hawaj is the backbone of most of our dishes, which is a spice blend that consists of cardamom, cumin, peppercorn, cinnamon, turmeric.
Hassan says this makes for spicy and savory Somali dishes. Of course, some of these recipes are in the cookbook, and they pair well with an unexpected ingredient, bananas.
The sweetness of the banana and then the heat of our hot sauces, the flavor combinations really set for a beautiful dish in a way that I think most people are not traditionally used to, because it's odd to have a banana with your meal for most people.
But bananas and plantains are actually really common in Indian Ocean cuisines. Khadija Farah is the photographer who researched and captured photos of the grandmothers for the cookbook. She is Kenyan Somali and grew up in Texas.
I didn't think that bananas or plantains were going to be as popular as they were, but yeah, they were pretty much cooked in every single country that I went to.
For example, kadaka akondro, a green plantain and beef dish made by one of the grandmothers from Mozambique. Some of the recipes featured in the cookbook are also national dishes, like langouste à la vanille or vanilla lobster from the island of Comoros.
It's surrounded by water. Obviously, they've got access to fresh seafood. So the reason why we wanted to highlight the lobster with the vanilla sauce is because it's decadent, it's holiday.
Decadent and elaborate, suited for American taste, Hassan explains. For Farah, the photographer, this cookbook is an opportunity to show off a more positive side of the region and its diverse cultures.
Growing up, I wasn't able to be as proud of my culture as I could have been. And obviously, that has a lot to do with representation.
She tells me she is excited that a young generation can now pick up the In Bibi's Kitchen cookbook and learn how to cook traditional and non-traditional foods inspired by their East African grandmothers. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Coming up, Jacinda Ardern surprised New Zealand and the globe with her resignation last week. We've got an update on the new prime minister. Coming up, you're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. South Korean TV shows are popular just about everywhere, including in North Korea, where watching South Korean television is illegal. Leader Kim Jong-un says these so-called K-dramas are a social cancer. But as The World's Patrick Nguyen reports, North Korean TV producers are now stepping up their game to try to compete with those dramas produced in the South.
There's a new thriller on the North Korean airwaves. It's called The Prosecutor's Office. In the pilot episode, a farmer walks through a dark forest and stumbles upon a gruesome crime. The farmer finds a man bloodied and half buried in the dirt, left to die. It's a mystery, one that North Korean officials must solve.
I watch their TV all the time, but this one was not typical. Honestly, I kind of liked it.
Seung-Yun Chong watches a lot of North Korean TV, but rarely enjoys it. It's her job. She's monitored North Korean programming for KBS, a South Korean state broadcaster, and she now watches it for an independent outlet, NK News. Everything from speeches to entertainment.
Most of the state media are all about the propaganda, so I'm kind of not sure if I can call them entertainment.
But when The Prosecutor's Office debuted on January 1st, Chong was startled at how edgy it was. She couldn't believe they dared to use this one word, which I won't repeat on the air, but it means bastard. I asked her, would you hear that in a South Korean film?
In a R-rated movie, yes. Not PG-13.
Usually, North Korean characters are used to model perfect behavior. They are relentlessly upbeat. For example, that is the theme song to a more typical show, which came out last year. It stars a woman in a factory making children's book bags. In a climactic scene, the woman tells her work unit how she reprogrammed all the electronic sewing equipment so that they could stitch book bags more efficiently. That, huh, is a male factory worker so amazed with her patriotism that he falls in love. Yes, this is what passes for a love story in North Korea. No wonder so many of them risk prison to watch K-dramas, buying CDs and USB drives on the black market. Seung-Yun Chong says The Prosecutor's Office is coming out just as Pyongyang officials promise to, quote, intensify state programming.
They try to produce a program that can appeal to young people, especially young people who have been increasingly exposed to South Korean drama.
What's most remarkable about this show, if you look past the violence, is it's a little nuanced. A war scene with Americans murdering North Koreans would be classic on-the-nose propaganda. But in The Prosecutor's Office, North Koreans are killing each other. That's rare. The real thrust of the show is tension between two officials, one of whom thinks the other is involved in the murder plot. It's not a television masterpiece, Chong says, but it's a huge step forward. That said, she doesn't know if it will really fulfill its mission, weaning young people off glitzy, big-budget K-dramas.
But older generations who are very used to watch typical North Korean movies and dramas, I think they might like it.
The Prosecutor's Office airs at 9:30 on Sunday nights. It's supposed to, anyway. Seung-Yun Chong tuned in 2 weeks ago and discovered the episode was bumped for coverage of Kim Jong-un attending some boring concert. She says she was bummed out, and that's when she knew she was a fan. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
New Zealand has elected a new interim prime minister, ending days of speculation over who would take over for Jacinda Ardern. Ardern announced last Thursday that she was stepping down from office and would not be seeking re-election. That surprised many New Zealanders. Reporter Ashley Westerman has been following the developments from Manila, and she joins us now. Who is the new interim prime minister, Ashley? Tell us about him.
So his name is Chris Hipkins. He's 44 years old, a career politician, and he's held lots and lots of jobs. He is the current minister of education. And, you know, in analyst circles, he's known as Ardern's go-to guy. He fixes things when she makes policy and political changes. And actually, people in New Zealand know him pretty well. His most notable work was as minister of health during the pandemic, and he led New Zealand's response to the virus. Here is Madison Burgess-Smith, a political consultant from Wellington.
Throughout our key COVID-19 lockdown, the Prime Minister and Chris Hipkins together held a press conference every day that was tuned into by millions of New Zealanders. So a lot of the goodwill that New Zealanders have towards the success of the pandemic response, many attribute to Ardern and Chris Hipkins.
Chris Hipkins was confirmed unanimously on Sunday by the Labour Party, and he will step in for Ardern when she steps down at the beginning of February.
Ashley, remind us why Jacinda Ardern stepped down.
So during her press conference on Thursday, you know, she said she just didn't have anything more in the tank to give. And she's been prime minister for nearly 6 years and has handled crisis after crisis after crisis. And she also has garnered a lot of favor from the West. She's pushed back on China's influence in the Pacific. And that's been really interesting for her at home because she's had to sort of perform this almost impossible balancing act, given that China is New Zealand's largest trading partner. And finally, she spent a lot of time standing up for women and combating the misogyny and sexism that comes with male-dominated politics during her time in office. And we saw all of these great things from the outside, right?
Yeah, elaborate on that. What do New Zealanders see that we don't as outsiders?
Yeah, so in New Zealand, things actually haven't been going so well for Ardern or her ruling party. Over the last year, as inflation and mortgage rates have risen, New Zealanders have become increasingly frustrated with the way she's handled the economy. And she's also been criticized for not addressing this uptick in crime that experts say is a result of displacement because of the pandemic. And, you know, a lot of New Zealanders were not happy with the long, multiple lockdowns. And analysts have told me that that is kind of what kicked off Ardern's demise was a lockdown in August of 2021 in Auckland with the arrival of the Delta variant. And that lockdown, that specific lockdown, became really divisive and polarizing. And so while outsiders still see her as a global political darling, Ardern's popularity has actually taken a hit. And in the latest polling, her party is trailing the opposition National Party.
Very interesting. So next October, there are general elections in New Zealand. Does Chris Hipkins replacing Jacinda Ardern help their Labour Party stay in power?
So the Labour Party may think it will help, but analysts aren't so sure. Here's Brad Thomas, a former government spokesman turned analyst.
She was a more polarizing figure by the time she resigned, but she was still the top political asset for the party. Hipkins doesn't have the same kind of level of recognition or popularity.
Now, to be fair, Thomas says Hipkins, he's more pragmatic about the economy and more hardliner on law and order issues. So a little bit to the right of Ardern. But whether that's enough to keep the Labour Party in power come October, that remains to be seen.
Reporter Ashley Westerman in Manila talking New Zealand politics with us and what difference the new interim Prime Minister Chris Hipkins will make when he takes office in a couple of weeks. Ashley, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Some films are just better on the big screen when you're with a crowd that knows it, like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, or in India, the movie DDLJ. Fans in Mumbai have been buying tickets since the 90s.
I love the romance, the songs that this movie is giving to all of us.
What's behind the film's long-lasting appeal? Ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Asian communities across the nation are on high alert this week following Saturday night shooting in Monterey Park, California. 11 people were killed and 10 more were wounded on the eve of the Lunar New Year, and now across the U.S. and many Chinatowns, security has increased. Meantime, across the globe where celebrations have not been marred by violence, Asian communities are marking the Lunar New Year throughout the week. In China, tens of millions of people have been traveling for the holiday, the first time they've been able to do so since the pandemic hit. They're visiting their families across the country for the Lunar New Year, and this concerns public health authorities there, that it could make the current wave of COVID much worse. In Taiwan, though, COVID cases have been relatively low for a while, and people there say they feel safe celebrating. Reporter Ashish Valentine has more from Taipei.
It's absolutely packed at Dihua Street in the heart of Taipei's historic Dadaocheng neighborhood. This is usually a quiet lane, home to shops selling herbal medicine, tea, and gifts. But for about a week every January, up to a million visitors come here to buy goods for the Lunar New Year, like dried foods and sweets. Everyone you see here is still wearing masks. Lin Yu-san works at a shop here selling traditional snacks. She says there's more people on the street than last year, and COVID isn't as big of a concern. She's glad she can give out free samples again, and people are encouraged to keep their hands clean. Many big city neighborhoods have become ghost towns, as almost everyone has taken a full week off work to celebrate with family. Public health experts here are expecting a rise in COVID cases as a result. But Jason Wong, a health policy expert at Stanford University, says it's unlikely the health system will be overwhelmed.
If somebody were to get COVID, you could just use telehealth and go to a designated pharmacy to get antivirals.
Almost 9 out of every 10 Taiwanese people have 2 doses of a COVID vaccine, and about 3/4 have had at least 1 booster. There aren't the same concerns here as in neighboring China, where the Lunar New Year migration combines with lagging vaccination rates amongst the elderly. Wang says the situation in Taiwan is different because of how it reopened.
Taiwan had a checklist to manage the potential chaos of reopening. It was staged, phase by phase. Right, so to gradually relax the restrictions.
Wang says that included waiting until vaccination rates were high enough, stocks of booster shots and antivirals were on hand, and the country had good levels of hospital and telehealth capacity. Given the rise in infections in China, Wang says another concern Taiwanese public health authorities have is new variants. In 2019, even before the pandemic, travel between China and Taiwan was already restricted. As a result, even now, as Chinese tourists finally dip their toes back into the outside world, Taiwan isn't seeing the same number of visits from China as neighboring countries.
One of the things that the Taiwan government has already done is to monitor travelers from China and to study the variants of travelers from China compared to travelers from elsewhere.
In a speech a few weeks ago, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen actually offered support to China in dealing with its COVID wave. We're aware that the pandemic situation has recently become more serious in China, she said. If need be, we are willing, out of humanitarian concern, to provide necessary assistance to help more people get through the pandemic and enjoy good health and peace of mind in the new year. At the Jiang household in the island's western city of Taichung, the Lunar New Year means hearty meals, gifts of red envelopes or hongbao with money inside, and long games of mahjong.
Oh my God! Yeah!
The family's grandfather, Jiang Duxin, says he's mostly happy with how Taiwan handled the pandemic. He's 86 and has had 4 COVID shots.
Because we have already more than 90% has injection. I don't think the COVID-19 has a big problem for the Taiwanese people.
Jiang actually had COVID about a month ago. While he was sick for a while, he's feeling better now. He said it's great to be able to celebrate safely this year.
Well, he's gathering all the family. It's good for us. It's a tradition. I always said that all will be very happy together.
For the world, this is Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
For 12 years, Dalton Paula in Brazil had his creative side, but his day job was as a firefighter. Today, the artist creates paintings, photos, and installations drawn from Brazil's black culture and history. Many of his works can be seen on the walls of the Museum of Modern Art in New York and the Art Institute of Chicago. Reporter Gisele Regatao visited Paula's studio in central Brazil and has this profile.
The door of Dalton Paula's home studio is always wide open.
But first, one has to pass through his sacred plants. The idea is that this is a space that welcomes and protects, he says. Paula is 40 years old and lives on the outskirts of Goiânia, 130 miles southwest of the capital, Brasília. He moved to the city with his mom and brother when he was 8. His dad had left when he was 2. He still lives in Goiânia, and he turned his home studio into an art school called Sertão Negro, or Black Hinterland. He says he created the school to support others the same way he was supported. He sees giving back as part of his role as an artist, particularly in the area of the country where he lives, and considering the recent vandalism of government buildings by supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro. I see the arts as a tool, he says. At Sertão Negro, anyone from the community can learn pottery, the dance and martial arts capoeira, and access a library with more than 1,000 books. The school also offers residency to artists and sells their work. Sertão Negro employs 9 people, including 3 artists who work as assistants to Paula and also produce their own work. We don't do anything alone here. Even my work, the paintings, I'm not doing that by myself anymore, he says. It took Paula many years to get here. He's been making art since he was a teenager. But he first went to college to study chemistry. He worked full-time as a firefighter. When he started studying visual arts at the Federal University of Goiás, he worked the night shift. I would rescue people who had been shot, stabbed, injured in car crashes, and after that I would study like a zombie falling asleep, he says. In 2011, his work was selected for a group show in São Paulo. It was a photo series showing him in front of walls, sometimes with his eyes or head covered. It's about the fact that, as a black man, he's often seen as a threat. His big break came in 2016, when he was invited to present at the prestigious São Paulo Biennial. 2 years later, he started visiting Quilombo communities in his state. Quilombos are settlements created during colonial times by escaped slaves. Out of these visits, Paula painted intricate portraits.
They're oil and gold leaf, and he always uses gold leaf in the hair.
Caroline Alexander owns the Soho Gallery Alexander & Bonin, which represents Paula in New York. She says for this series, Paula photographs people in Afro-Brazilian communities and paints them using research about those who lived there in the 18th and 19th centuries.
And he takes a history, and he takes his photograph, and he matches them. So he gives these people, who were never photographed or drawn, an identity.
Their faces are painted in layers. Their noses are emphasized in beige because Paula's mom used to tell him to press his nose to make it thinner. The paintings cost $25,000 each. Paula sold 6 of these paintings to the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 2020.
I personally knew that Dalton Paula was somebody who I wanted to be in a lifelong relationship with. That's how I am when I, you know, work with people. It's kind of forever.
Thomas Jean Lax is a curator at MoMA who orchestrated the acquisition of the paintings. He says he appreciates that with these portraits, Paula is imagining who his subjects could have been.
That dimension of the unknown, of embracing the unknown, is really important, not only for his work, but also give black artists the full range of possibilities as we bear witness to the things that they have made.
Paula's latest piece is a commission from the Pinacoteca Museum in São Paulo. It's called Cotton Root, and it features dozens of bottles and jars covered in white cotton canvas. They are displayed on several altars surrounded by white fabric. Caroline Paz is a graduate student in cultural criticism and is visiting the museum for the first time with her parents.
Achei tudo muito assim, sabe? Enigmático.
She says she found the piece enigmatic. The installation is about the economic and cultural impact of cotton production in Brazil and the U.S. Paz says the work has important symbolism for black Brazilians like her. Many are still on the margins. It's a constant struggle. But it's very important to know that we have here today the work of someone who can show his art to the world, particularly because he's a black artist, she says. Dalton Paula is now working on several new pieces, including paintings and installations, some with materials he has never worked with before. I'm always doing this exercise when something is very set. I create new challenges for myself. And that's the work of a lifetime, the work of an artist, he says. For the world, I'm Gisele Regatao, Goiânia, Brazil.
There are some movies from years gone by that are so popular they keep coming back to the big screen. But it's hard to think of any film that has gotten the kind of screen time that one movie has had in downtown Mumbai. One theater there has been playing this feature for nearly 27 years. Fans still come from across India to watch this beloved Bollywood movie. And now it's aiming to hit the stage in the United States. Namratha Kolachlam has a story from Mumbai.
It's called Dilwale Dulhaniya Le Jayenge, or affectionately, DDLJ, and it's the longest-running film in India's history.
Literally at home, I already watched this movie almost 270 times.
That's Sankit Salve. He traveled 7 hours by train to watch this film at the Maratha Mandir in central Mumbai. This iconic single-screen theater plays DDLJ each day at 11:30 a.m. Salve is here with 500 other people, cheering, clapping, and dancing along. DDLJ tells the story of traditional good girl Simran and Casanova party boy Raj. They fall in love in Europe and must find a way to stay together despite family objections. When released in 1995, the movie turned its actress, Kajol, and its actor, Shah Rukh Khan, into superstars. Today, people refer to him as SRK, or even King Khan.
I love the romance, the songs that this movie is giving to all of us. They are just, wow. Yeah, that's all I can say.
This is moviegoer Akshita Pawar.
And yeah, I watched this movie before on like television and all, but yeah, I just want a theater experience of the movie. And of course, SRK's and Kajol's Jodi is the best.
By Jodi, she's referring to the pairing of the two actors. Since 1995, they've gone on to work on several other classic films together. But aside from our main stars, what made DDLJ so popular? According to Rajinder Dudra, a professor of cultural studies at Birmingham City University, it probably has something to do with timing. In 1995, India was opening up its economy to the world. And crucially, DDLJ's main characters are non-resident Indians, or NRIs, living in London.
It encapsulates India on the verge of change technologically, economically, culturally, but also India on the verge in relation to its NRI population.
For the massive Indian diaspora living in the West, the film captured the tensions of remaining true to their traditional Indian roots while also exploring the world. And for those in India, Dudra says that the scene set in Europe fed into growing middle-class aspirations.
You didn't have to be uber rich, you didn't have to be highly rich, but you could be rich in a very middle class or upwardly mobile way to have these fantasies of wanting to go abroad. And DDLJ certainly helped with those aspirations and those fantasies.
It may have some cringy 90s moments, but teenagers, families, couples on a date, they all have their favorite scenes and songs from the film. For Jeevan Katamurthy, it's when our hero, Raj, comically drops Simran in front of a crowd of people.
It's very funny. Every time I see it, I'll just laugh.
He also loves the film's most famous musical number.
My favorite song is, of course, Tujhe Dekha To Ye Jaana Sanam.
But perhaps the most memorable moment comes at the end, when you fear that our heroes will be parted forever. Simran begs her father to let go of her wrist so that she can join Raj on a moving train. And then, at the last possible moment, he releases her and says, "Go, Simran, go. Live your life." Outside the Maratha Mandir Theater, when I went in December, a sign read that DDLJ had been playing for 1,354 weeks. The theater's executive director, Manoj Desai, says part of the film's success, day after day, week after week, is the ticket prices. Only 30 to 40 rupees, between 37 and 50 cents. For 3 hours of epic romance, it's a steal. And Desai has no plans to end the run.
Till the public comes like this, I'll keep on running. We don't bother for, profit.
And soon, DDLJ might have even more international fans. The film's director, Aditya Chopra, has adapted the story for the stage. After an extended run at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, the team aims to go to Broadway soon. But back in Mumbai, the matinee screening of the film will keep running at the Maratha Mandir each day. So there's plenty more opportunities for moments like this between two friends.
She was laughing, she was screaming with me.
It was too good.
We were dancing in the end. We danced, we loved it.
They said they would try to come again the very next day. For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam in Mumbai.
The American role in the Vietnam War came to an end in Paris 50 years ago this month. A small team of diplomats, including Henry Kissinger, who was President Richard Nixon's national security advisor at the time, they'd been meeting with the North Vietnamese trying to end the war. The talks in Paris were completely secret. Not even the State Department knew about them. Then, on this day in 1973, President Nixon announced a peace deal.
At 12:30 Paris time today, January 23, 1973, the agreement on ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam was initialed by Dr. Henry Kissinger on behalf of the United States and Special Advisor Lee Duc Tho on behalf of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam.
Pierre Asselin is an historian at San Diego State University who studied everything that went into the treaty. So secret peace talks and then suddenly not so secret, Pierre. Why was this the right time for a successful agreement with the North Vietnamese?
Basically, both sides were exhausted. Nixon mostly politically, as well as diplomatically. Hanoi largely militarily. By 1972, the U.S. is supposed to be on its way out of Vietnam. And yet that same year, the air war specifically will escalate dramatically. They decided to finalize an agreement that ended American involvement in the war. I think that's a very important thing to understand, right? That the Paris Agreement does not end the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War is fundamentally a Vietnamese civil war. Both Washington and Hanoi would claim that the agreement represented a victory.
So, Pierre, as I said, the Paris peace talks were secret, very secret, and it seems Henry Kissinger was the actor determined to keep them secret. Why?
So there were technically two peace talks going on simultaneously. The first ones were semi-public, and those are the ones that the Johnson administration initiated with Hanoi. But because they were semi-public, each side essentially used them for propaganda purposes. And when Nixon assumed the presidency, he figured that those talks were useless. And therefore, if they wanted to gauge how North Vietnam really felt, it was really kind of best to open a secret channel, a so-called back channel, as he called it. And that secrecy really allowed for the talks with North Vietnam to become significantly more constructive.
So inside the negotiating room in Paris, there was a struggle going on. But from what we know, there was also a lot happening outside the negotiating room. What things did the U.S. and North Vietnamese do outside the room to get leverage?
It was basically a combination of diplomatic and military actions. Nixon realizes that Hanoi is basically only as strong as the support it's getting from outside. And that's one of the reasons that he's going to very aggressively engage the Soviets and the Chinese. What he's really trying to do is drive a wedge between Hanoi on the one hand and then Beijing and Moscow on the other. And as he's doing that, he's also going to increase the military pressure on Hanoi. And then Hanoi, for its part, will more or less do the same thing, right? Kind of amp up the military pressure to get the Americans to leave. When I look at Ukraine today and Zelensky, he's basically kind of copying the Vietnamese communist playbook during the Vietnam War in terms of endearing himself to the international community, developing a cult of personality, which are things that the North Vietnamese did with Ho Chi Minh, inviting famous people to come and see the country and the crimes perpetrated by the enemy, right? Jane Fonda coming into northern Vietnam. So diplomatically, Hanoi proved very, very adept.
So maybe some of Nixon's policies were proved effective. Policies like what?
looking at the bombing, for example, right, like the resumption of the bombing under Nixon, the so-called linebacker and linebacker two campaigns. I mean, they were extremely violent, and they may have constituted war crimes under international law, but they were effective. There's no question that they really rattled Hanoi's cage. Hanoi never thought that Nixon would have the audacity to escalate the war like he did in an election year. Hanoi always played the American political calendar, right? The Tet Offensive in 68, they do this because they know there's an election year and it's going to be more difficult for Johnson to counter them.
And right, then and then, of course, Nixon's election in November 72, you're saying, was the same thing?
That's exactly it. And they really think, and we know this from the Vietnamese documentary record, right? They think that because of the looming election and the fact that 4 years ago almost, right, Nixon had promised peace with honor, there's no way that Nixon is going to respond forcefully to this so-called spring offensive. And to their shock and awe, not only does Nixon resume the bombing, but then he wins by a landslide. And that really, I'm not endorsing the morality of the bombing, but as far as the impact from Nixon's standpoint, it had the desired impact upon Hanoi and became a major reason why Hanoi would start to negotiate much more seriously in late 72 than it had been negotiating before that. So I think one of the big kind of lessons that we really need to take account of here is the fact that, meaningful as the agreement was, it ended American involvement in a very, very devastating war. But for the Vietnamese themselves, that war would go on for another 2 years, claim thousands of more lives, and not end really until Saigon was captured by communist forces in April of 1975.
Pierre Asseline is a historian at San Diego State University who's done deep research into the Paris Peace Accords, which ended the U.S. engagement in Vietnam, a deal announced by President Richard Nixon 50 years ago today. Pierre, thanks very much for your time.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Haitian roots music, or musique racine, is a style that emerged in the 1970s, bringing together influences like Haitian folk, elements of voodoo percussion, and even punk. What you're hearing is not pure musique racine, but it is deeply influenced by the genre. This is Haitian artist Moonlight Benjamin, who proudly cites musique racine as informing her sound, but so does Alabama Shake's lead singer Brittany Howard, Mali Enchanteuse Umu Sangare, as well as Queen's Freddie Mercury. Moonlight Benjamin has just released her third album, titled Wayo. As a 30-something, Moonlight left Haiti and moved to France in 2002. But even 20-plus years later, Haiti remains a focus for her. This is the second single from her new album. The song is titled Bafon and serves as a metaphor about Haiti. In it, Moonlight Benjamin sees her country as a person. The lyrics begin a story in which Haiti is dying and is taken to a cemetery, but the guardian of the graves says he does not have the approval of his master and refuses entry to Haiti. She still has life in her, he says. For Moonlight Benjamin, the story she embeds in her song and the meaning it has for a country go back to the name her father gave her when she was born, Moonlight. As she told Dutch public television a few years ago,
qui m'a donné ce prénom pour aller aider les gens.
He gave me this name to help educate people and to help them rediscover the light, she says. Moonlight Benjamin also says, even though the dysfunction in Haiti often leaves her crying, her song Bafon is a message of hope for her people back home. New music there from Haitian singer and songwriter Moonlight Benjamin. It's off her latest recording, Wayo, and that is our cue to say so long today. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Be safe, stay strong. We're back with you tomorrow.